From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, Mary Tyler Moore talks about the characters she's played and how they've reflected and influenced her life. She's currently starring in the new film, Flirting with Disaster. And on the eve of the 1996 New Orleans Jazz Heritage Festival, we talked to one of New Orleans' native talents, singer and songwriter Mac Rebenack. He's better known to many of his fans as Dr. John. And Ken Tucker reviews the Pulitzer Prize-winning musical Rent, which opened on Broadway this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The unemployment rate fell 0.2% last month to 5.4%. That's the lowest level in more than a year. But few new jobs were created in April. NPR's John Itzty reports.
Despite the drop in the unemployment rate, the monthly survey of business payrolls showed only 2,000 new jobs were created in April. That's far below the average for the first quarter of the year, when businesses were adding an average of 221,000 jobs a month. April saw a big drop in the number of construction and manufacturing jobs and only a slight increase in service sector jobs. The good news on the unemployment rate comes from a separate monthly survey of households, but even that survey shows no growth in the number of jobs. The data reveal that the unemployment rate fell because fewer workers were entering the workforce in April. Today's report casts some doubt that the economy is expanding as rapidly now as it did in the first 3 months of the year. I'm John Idstein in Washington.
The Labor Department says it has recovered nearly $1.4 million in back wages for thousands of garment workers who were victimized by sweatshops. A department investigation over the last several months found over 200 instances of companies paying workers less than the minimum wage. Most of the abuses happened in New York City and Southern California. The Senate Finance Committee is holding hearings today on a GOP proposal to roll back a 4.3-cent-a-gallon gasoline tax hike enacted in 1993. The committee's chairman, William Roth of Delaware, says rescinding the tax would help soften the blow of recent sharp hikes in prices at the pump. One of the leaders of the 1989 Tiananmen Square democracy movement has been granted political asylum in the United States. NPR's Mary Kay Magstad reports.
Liu Gang has not revealed how he managed to elude the Chinese security forces assigned to him and escape to the United States. Liu Gang served 6 years in prison because of his leading role in Tiananmen Square. During his prison term, he was dubbed Man of Iron Blood because even after repeated torture and beatings, he continued to organize prisoners to hold hunger strikes and demand better conditions. Once released, Liu resumed contact with international human rights groups and exiled dissidents. But this prompted even more intense government harassment of him. Eventually, Liu told Reuters, it just got to be too much, and he had to leave. He has urged the Chinese government not to persecute his family because of his departure. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Hong Kong.
On Wall Street, stock prices are rebounding somewhat today after yesterday's sharp drop. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently up 16 points at 5,514 in heavy trading of 184 million shares. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite Index is up nearly 13 points. You're listening to NPR News. A powerful earthquake rocked a wide area of northern China today, killing at least 8 people and injuring over 100 others. The tremor had a magnitude of 6.4 on the Richter scale. It was centered in the region of Inner Mongolia, and it flattened dozens of old one-story homes. A moderate earthquake shook the Seattle area last night. There were no reports of significant injuries or damage. But in the King Dome, the Mariners baseball game was postponed and tens of thousands of fans were sent home. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The quake measuring 5.4 on the Richter scale was centered in Duval, about 25 miles northeast of downtown Seattle. There have been no reports of significant damage or injuries, though one woman fractured her arm as she ran to check on her children as the quake struck at 9:04 local time. Area engineers have checked the region's bridges, vital transportation links here, and have found no problems. At the Kingdom, a structure that's been under attack for being seismically unsafe, a Mariners baseball game was suspended in the seventh inning and fans sent home. No damage was found there either. This region is seismically active. Last night's quake was the area's largest since a 6.5 tremor struck the Seattle-Tacoma area in 1965. That quake caused 7 deaths and major damage. In Seattle, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas reportedly is resting comfortably after a bone marrow transplant from his sister. The Boston Herald says Tsongas received the transplant this week to treat a precancerous condition triggered by cancer treatments he received a decade ago. As authorities in southern Maryland have scaled back their search for missing CIA Director William Colby, Colby's family members and friends are picking up the slack. Although most of the focus has been on the river area where Colby's empty canoe was found Sunday, officials say there is still some hope that he may be alive somewhere in the wilderness along the shore. The local sheriff says it's possible he made it to shore, but he's too injured to find help. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Two of TV's greatest sitcoms starred Mary Tyler Moore, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and, of course, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Over the years, Mary Tyler Moore has played several extremes very convincingly. The sitcom Mary, the person everyone wants as their best friend, and the cold, steely mother she portrayed in the film Ordinary People. Currently, she can be seen playing another uptight mother in the comic movie Flirting with Disaster. Terry Gross spoke with Mary Tyler Moore last fall. Her autobiography, After All, had just been published. She told Terry that her first big break in show business was playing the happy Hot Point elf for Hot Point appliance commercials broadcast during the Ozzie and Harriet show.
Happy Hot Point was the logo of Hot Point Appliances come to life, an elf, a little figure with a shock of blonde hair protruding from her little gray pixie cap that also had ears on it. But I was a happy Hot Point, and I would, in these commercials, be superimposed on the ice cube trays, skating, popping out of the washing machine, speaking to Harriet Nelson and saying things like, "Hi, Harriet, aren't you glad you use Hot Point appliances?" Except my voice was higher then, so it sounded a lot more pixie-ish than it does now. What had happened was that at that time, and this was immediately after graduating from high school, I also got married immediately after graduating from high school. And about a month after that, I was pregnant. And the commercials were almost impossible to do anymore because I had my breasts bound down to begin with, even before I was pregnant, because pixies are supposedly of neuter gender. And to try to do that after I was even 1 month along, and certainly into 2 and 3, was impossible. And so we had to stop. And I think they just went to straight commercials after that. And I went on to happily have my baby a few months after that.
Well, after you had your baby, you were the voice of the woman in the answering service for the TV detective Richard Diamond.
Right. That was played by David Janssen, and it was, I guess it had started on radio, and one of the successful elements of it was a character called Sam, short for Samantha, who was the answering service woman who took Richard Diamond's telephone messages. This was, of course, predating answering machines. And he would check in with me 2 or 3 times every episode, and I would answer in the sexiest imaginable voice, "Hi, Mr. T. I have some messages for you." And nobody ever saw Sam. You were allowed to imagine her to be your idea, your fantasy of the most gorgeous creature ever, certainly far from the reality of Mary Tyler Moore, who at the time was a fast 23 or 22 years old, freckle face, all-American girl next door type.
Now, let me jump ahead to the Dick Van Dyke Show. What were you told about the character of Laura?
Just that she was going to be a wife, a television wife, and that really had its classical parameters and dimensions, and they were established, and they hardly ever varied except as to whether or not the wife was the star of the show, in which case she was the funny one, or if she were the straight man for the male star, and she was then totally supportive. But all these wives were kind of obedient and, you know, a representative of the vows to love, honor, and obey. They hardly varied from that. And with Carl Reiner's character, the way she was written, Laura actually had opinions of her own. And while she was asserting herself, she also didn't make Dick Van Dyke look like a dummy. It was a matter of two people. I mean, society's expectations at that point still said, hey, wait a minute, lady, you only go so far here. But I think we broke new ground. And that was helped by my insistence on wearing pants, you know, jeans and capri pants at the time, because I said I've seen all the other actresses and they're always running the vacuum in these little flowered frocks with high heels on, and I don't do that, and I don't know any of my friends who do that, so why don't we try to make this real, and I'll dress on the show the way I do in real life.
But it wasn't that easy. The sponsors were afraid you'd look brazen.
Right. They pointed specifically to, they used a term, cupping under, and I can only assume that that meant my seat, that there was a little too much definition, and so they allowed me to continue to wear them in one episode, one scene per episode, and only after we checked to make sure that there was as little cupping under as possible. But
cupping under referring to the fit of your pants.
The fit of the pants,
on
yes.
On your behind.
On my behind, right. But within a few weeks, we were sneaking them into a few other scenes in every episode, and they were definitely cupping under, and everyone thought it was great. And the funny thing is, you know, women liked me. They were not envious of the fact that their husbands had a crush on me. It was okay with them. They were the first to, you know, when I would meet people, they'd say, my husband loves you so much, and he thinks you're so sexy. And this was an odd thing, because they were also able to identify with me as a friend, as a girlfriend. There was no resentment, no fear.
Yeah, well, I think that speaks so well for the character and your portrayal of her. Now, how did you come up with the voice to say, oh, Rob?
I don't know. I guess it began with the cry. The first time I cried was the episode in which Laura bleaches her hair blonde, looks in the mirror, and with her friend Millie's help decides she looks more like Harpo Marx than what her goal had been. And so she quickly tries to dye it back before Rob gets home from work. Now, this is a real stretch of the imagination. She decides to dye one half of her head back, not being able to get the other half done before Dick walks in the door. And so she greets him, half blonde, half brunette, and sobbing. And I had always been a big fan of Nanette Fabre, who worked with Carl Reiner and Sid Caesar on the shows. And I loved her humor. I loved the way she cried. And so when I was called upon to bring forth the tears in my scene, I'm not sure how much of it was out-and-out stolen from Miss Fabre and how much of it was just a matter of influence, but there was definitely a cracking in the voice and an inability to maintain a tone and a certain amount of verbal yodeling that took place. And from that came, oh, Rob!
I have another question about Laura Petrie's look.
Yeah.
Laura wore a flip. Perfect little flip.
Yes.
Whose idea was the flip? And how were you wearing your hair in real life at the time?
In real life, I was wearing it in a flip, but it wasn't quite as backcombed and lacquered as it was on the show. I mean, that thing had so much hairspray on it, you could hang clothes from it.
When you say that thing, was it your hair or was it a wig?
Yeah, it was my hair, but it was quite thoroughly sprayed and done by somebody else. But my in person, in between shows, that was the way I wore it. It was just a little limper.
Well, let's talk about The Mary Tyler Moore Show, a show which I still love to watch. I'm so glad that Nick at Night carries these shows. I still love to watch The Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore. Now, The Mary Tyler Moore Show got started because CBS wanted to build a series around you.
Mm-hmm.
And you and Grant Tinker hired people to, you know, come up with the idea, write a series. What was the original premise?
The original premise was not too different from the one that we ended up pursuing, but I was to be divorced from a doctor, and rather than having, as we ended up doing, having me live with this doctor through medical school and internship and residency and then been dumped. CBS felt that having been divorced was unacceptable from a societal point of view, that people would see nothing humorous in divorce. How could you possibly laugh at a woman who had a broken marriage in her past? And not only that, but my God, they would think you were divorced from Dick Van Dyke, the world's most wonderful, adorable person.
That's so silly.
Yeah. And instead, what's so odd from a morality point of view is that they found it acceptable that I had lived with this doctor, never married him, and then the relationship broke up and I went off to start my new life. So I don't know. Morality, I guess, is a very personal thing.
The character of Ted Baxter was originally conceived as being someone of your age.
Right.
And there might be some, like, romantic attraction between you?
Exactly. He was probably going to be tall, dark, and handsome, and instead what walked through the door was Ted Knight. Short, white-haired, and handsome, yes, but not what you'd call a love interest. But the writers, the writer-producers, Jim and Alan, were so open, and they saw this man, and they began to think potential. All right, so it isn't our original idea, but oh, wow, look and feel and salivate over all the juicy stories we could do in another direction.
I think one of the real famous moments in television openings, you know, one of the famous freeze frames is you throwing your hat in the air
mm-hmm.
in the opening of the show with the
right.
jingle underneath.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
Oh, do I? It was freezing cold. It was in Minneapolis in January, I think, or February. And we didn't know what we were doing. We were just there to grab a lot of footage that shows a young woman's exuberance, being in a new city, looking around, gazing at the sights. And I had in my hand a hat, a little beret that my aunt had given me for Christmas. And I had packed that along with whatever other warm things that I had, which weren't too many because I was a Californian, to go to Minneapolis to do these film spots. And Jim Brooks said, oh, I have a good idea, Bering. Take that hat, put it on your head, and now run into the intersection, and it'll be all right. We'll watch for cars. And throw it up in the air as if to say, this is my town, and I'm celebrating my life that is taking place. And I did it, and luckily, magically, wasn't hit by a car, although I got some pretty strange looks. And in fact, I guess it must be in every episode, you can see this one woman in the background who looks at me as if not only am I the world's strangest person, but that she would like to personally lock me up. But it's interesting, isn't it, that something that becomes burned in people's impressions and memories can happen so happenstancely out of nowhere. It wasn't written. It was just a spur-of-the-moment idea.
So that traffic was the real thing.
Oh, yeah, it was. And it's a good thing I didn't have to speak any lines because my lips weren't working. It was so cold. I literally could not form words.
Huh.
Mary Tyler Moore talking with Terry Gross. Mary Tyler Moore currently appears in the new movie, Flirting with Disaster. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Mary Tyler Moore.
I have a colleague here who said, the Mary Tyler Moore show made me who I am today, single. And I thought that was particularly funny because, you know, all those years you were playing Mary Tyler Moore, you had no idea what it was like to be single. You got
right.
married as soon as you got out of high school. You divorced, but you were only single for about 6 months before marrying Grant Tinker.
That's right. Boy, you've read the book, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes.
So really, you'd never lived that kind of single life.
No, I hadn't. And when Grant and I finally ended our marriage and I went to New York to do a Broadway play, Whose Life Is It Anyway?, I decided to stay in New York and try to capture my life for myself. I had never been on my own. I had never experienced any of the situations that Mary Richards had lived for the rest of the world every week. And I set about to make that happen for myself. I dated, I made friends, I had a little apartment, I did my own shopping and schlepped my own clothes to the dry cleaner and back and the laundry and all of that stuff. And I sort of generally played house, but in real life.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit about your own family when you were growing up, since after all, you know, you portrayed one of the most famous couples on television on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and then had a wonderful family of friends and colleagues.
Yes.
On the Mary Tyler Moore Show. When you were growing up, your own family was probably what we'd now call dysfunctional.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose so. It's an overused phrase, and I wish we could be a little more specific about it.
I agree.
My, I didn't mean to
criticize you for that. I didn't take it that way.
My mother and father were very much the couple that Grant Tinker and I became. They say that you do follow the patterns that you grow up in, and this was certainly true in my case. WASP, repressed, unable to deal with things that are uncomfortable, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, not discussing anything that's ugly or unpleasant, and just muddling through. A little of Beth Jarrett in Ordinary People came from those people, from myself. And I emulated that with Grant Tinker. My father is a very well-educated intellectual, a lover of classical music and classical literature. My mother was an English major, and everything was just perfect in that house, but nobody was talking to anybody.
Well, another thing that was less than perfect is your mother drank.
My mother was an alcoholic, as I was to become. Her alcoholism took another form from mine. She would, by the dint of determination, be sober for months at a time and then be unable to continue. And all of the problems that had been building up and she had been stuffing under the rug of her emotions would burst forth, and she would start drinking in the day, and she would not stop until somebody found the bottle and took it away and pretty much held her captive in the house until she sobered up and we were able to plead with her to stop, and then she would try again. Back then, nobody knew what we know about alcoholism today and the kind of counseling it takes and the kind of sharing and support that is needed to get through this, to break this cycle. Feel now, I think most scientists agree that there is a genetic predisposition to alcohol, which in combination with other factors in life is going to almost guarantee some form of dependency in later life. My form of alcoholism was much more controlled because I grew up in that very uncomfortable, very sad situation, and I determined that I was never going to do that, never be drunk. And I probably never was really out and out drunk. And I certainly never drank during the daytime. But I wasted a lot of my time, and I forgot a lot because I didn't remember much of what had happened the night before. I got out of proportion angry about things that were really unimportant, but that's what alcohol does to you.
Did being an actress help you be able to drink and not show the signs of it? Help you cover it up?
Maybe so. I don't think so, though, because once your speech is slurred, once you lose balance, there's no way you can pretend that away. But I paced myself. I never allowed myself to drink any more than the company I was with. And that way nobody could judge me, nobody could see.
Did you drink alone?
Yeah, I did, but I was seldom alone. Except when I moved to New York, and then I was alone, and then my drinking really escalated. Mm-hmm. And I found myself not going out after 5 o'clock and making sure that everything was set up for me to have my dinner there on the bed that was by the air conditioner that was near the phone, that was near the television set, and that I had my blender full of drinks that I was concocting in an attempt to do something worthwhile in the kitchen. It was a pretty sad lady that was emerging.
Were you afraid that the press would find out that you drank a lot, and it would be
no,
this
because
whole thing. Yeah.
I didn't think I drank a lot.
Oh, I
that's
see.
The amazing part of it. Uh-huh. Most alcoholics are in such a state of denial about their condition. They will blame everything but themselves for whatever is going on. I didn't have hangovers per se, but I found that it was getting very difficult to hold the eyeliner brush steady when I was applying my makeup in the morning. So I thought, well, I guess that's just something that happens when you enter your 40s, and it's a nerve-wracking city, so I'll just have to, you know, take a little more time with it or use a thinner brush, whatever. And I had nobody to point out to me the lack of sense that I was making and the deterioration of my thinking.
You stopped drinking, I think it was, what, the mid-80s?
It was 11 years ago, yeah, I guess. That was the mid-80s, yes. 86?
You did Betty Ford.
Right.
Do you think your emotional character changed after you stopped drinking?
Oh, there's no question about it. In a way, I sometimes feel grateful that I did have this alcoholism. Except that there were so many sad events that were caused by it that I can't wholeheartedly say that. But at least it got me to the Betty Ford Center, where I was able to, with the help of some counselors and a lot of group therapy sessions, examine myself and the way I handled my life and the way I handled problems and the way I reacted to any given situation and was able to make major changes. I allowed myself to be imperfect. I allowed myself to make mistakes and laugh at it, to handle my real-life mistakes the way I handled the acting mistakes on the Dick Van Dyke Show, to think of those as positive steps forward rather than anything to be ashamed of.
Mary Tyler Moore stars in the new film Flirting with Disaster. The title of a recent autobiography is After All. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Who can turn the world on with her smile? Who can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile? Well, it's you, girl, and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show it, love is all around, no need to waste it. You can have the town, why don't you take it? You're gonna make it after all. Love is all around, no need to waste it. You can have the town, why don't you take it?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The New Orleans Jazz Heritage Festival starts this weekend, and we have an interview with one of the city's most famous performers, Mac Rebennack, better known as Dr. John. Also, critic Ken Tucker reviews the most highly anticipated Broadway musical of the season, Rent.
Such a night. Such a night. Best friend Jim. And here I am, trying to steal you away from him. Oh, but if I don't do it, you know somebody else will. If I don't do it, you know somebody else will. If I don't do it, you know somebody else will. If I don't do it, you know somebody else will. And it's such a night. It's such a night. Sweet confusion under the moonlight.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Terry's guest on this archive edition of Fresh Air is musician, songwriter, and singer Mac Rebenack, who's better known to many of his listeners as Dr. John. Dr. John is appearing this weekend at the New Orleans Jazz Heritage Festival. This is Memories of Professor Longhair, Dr. John's tribute to a New Orleans mentor, Professor Longhair. Mac Rebenack grew up in New Orleans and came of age when the city was one of the rock and roll capitals. In his teens, he worked as a session musician and producer with performers that epitomized the New Orleans sound, like Jimmy Clanton, Frankie Ford, and Huey Piano Smith. In the mid-60s, he left for Los Angeles, where he created the Dr. John persona. As Dr. John the Night Tripper, he led a production that combined voodoo, psychedelia, and old medicine shows. He'd emerge on stage dressed in sparkling robes and shoot glitter out over the audience. In the early 80s, Rebenack moved to New York and made his record debut as a solo rhythm and blues pianist. Back when Mac Rebenack was a teenager, he played the New Orleans clubs with older musicians who promised his parents they'd look out for him. When he spoke with Terry Gross in 1986, he told her what the club scene was like.
Most of the clubs were fronts for something else. It was like the bee drinkers and all working prostitution out the backs of the clubs. They all had these motels connected to them. There was gambling going on, like in all these hidden rooms around the clubs. And it was all pretty, what was great about it was it left the club owners hired bands that played music that they liked. And there was a lot of freedom, so bands in those days did not have to play for the public. They played for club owners that enjoyed music. And what happened, there was a lot of clubs that had bebop music or different forms of music that was great for musicians who weren't under pressure to pack people in a club. Because these guys didn't even care if there was any people necessarily in the club, because that's not where their money was necessarily coming.
There are a lot of knife fights or gun fights at some of the rougher clubs that you played.
Oh, yeah. Some of the joints were real, you know, typical bucket of blood joints. And there was some of the places that my family knew I was working, and some of them would have just pulled me out the whole scene. I mean, there was nights that guys would push me behind, like these one-armed bandits, little slot machines, and would use them like shields and shove me behind them when they'd see the guns come out and stuff. And, man, it was a night, you know, that somebody got shot, stabbed, or whatever.
If the guns or the knives were coming out, were you supposed to keep playing?
Yes, we always were instructed to play loud and fast when trouble happened. That was kind of the rule of thumb. when troubles start, you play loud and fast.
What was that supposed to accomplish?
Drown out the trouble.
Oh. Did it work?
Yeah.
So people wouldn't notice that much what was happening?
Yeah, so the bouncer could clear the people out the place, and usually nobody was the wiser that somebody was murdered or whatever happened. It was usually not even noticed by the bulk of the paying people.
Was there a separate black and white music scene when you were coming of age?
Well, there were separate unions. There was segregated unions, which was a real problem for me because especially as I was working in a recording scene, I had flack from the white union for hiring black musicians. I had flack from the black musician about hiring white musicians. So both unions were giving me trouble for hiring the other guys when what I was doing was trying to hire the best guys to fill the jobs.
How did you start doing studio work?
Well, I hung at the studio, myself and James Booker and several of the musicians. As kids, we just literally hung at the studio hoping somebody would get sick or get hurt and that we'd get the sub for them. And, I mean, literally, we made, you know, novenas to the saints that somebody would get ill, that we'd get a chance to play. And we'd wait. And occasionally, somebody would be late, and we'd get to play for a little bit. And usually, they'd come, and we'd get shooed out again. But slowly but surely, we kind of got accepted into the clique. And it was, like, I think, more to do with persistence than talent, you know.
I want to play a recording from your Gumbo album, and it's Those Lonely, Lonely Nights. What did you choose to do this song?
Well, I was looking for some Earl King songs. Earl was one of them. He and Huey Smith were two of the guys that encouraged me to keep on writing songs. And they were like the up-and-coming guys. Like Huey Smith was the young piano player coming up at that time, and Earl King was like called Little Guitar Slim, who was like the hero of the guitars at the time.
And why don't we hear it? You're featuring on piano and vocals.
Right.
On this recording of Those Lonely, Lonely Nights from Dr. John MacRibbonack's album, Gumbo.
There's been some lonely, lonely nights. Oh, baby, yes, since you've been gone. Lay my head on my pillow. Oh, how I cried all night long. The thing you used to say to me.
Dr. John, talking with Terry Gross in 1986. Dr. John is appearing this weekend in the New Orleans Jazz Heritage Festival. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Day has been dark since you've been gone.
Back with Terry Gross's interview with singer-songwriter Dr. John.
Yeah, no, you went from this background of playing a music rooted in jazz and blues and early rock and roll, and then you became one of the leading figures in psychedelic music, and you'd created this persona for yourself, the Dr. John persona. How was that created? Was it your idea to do that?
Well, I had always came up with album concepts. I would think of like, this will be a project, and I would come up with like a lot of album projects so that if I had some work to do, that we'd have projects to fill in to do. And the Dr. John thing was, the idea was at the time there was no real shows that were out around. And the concept was to take all of the tricknology that I knew of show business from over the years, like throwing glitter to make the effect of magic, and using a lot of concepts that were easily and cheaply adaptable to show business and to make a show that would be real mystical in orientation for people. And it was a real, like, easy-to-do show. And all I had to do was to get a group of dancers, and I got all these people from New Orleans who were real familiar with that kind of music. And we did the album, and the show was geared to the snake dancers and all the regular voodoo shows of New Orleans. And unfortunately, when I first presented it, it was a little too authentic for the labels. They weren't quite ready for a guy biting a chicken's head off and stuff. So we modified the show down to a lot less authenticness, to more showbiz style, and took it on the road.
I want to play something from one of your early Dr. John the Night Tripper records, and this is from the Grigri album, and it's Grigri Gumbo Yaya. Do you want to say anything about when you started doing this song and how you'd get into it?
Well, this was the introduction song. Like, on the show, I would step on a button and have a big puff of smoke and say, they call me, and as the smoke cleared, it would look like I had just popped up. You know, it's an old magic trick. And that was like the introduction song to our show. And this also was like introducing myself to the audience as who and what Dr. John is.
They call me Dr. John, known as the Night Tripper. Got my satchel of gris in my hand. They be tripping up and back down the bayou. I'm the last of the best, they call me the Grigri man. Got many clients, come from miles around, running down my prescription. I got medicine to cure all y'all's ills. I got remedies of every description. I got
Grigri Gumbo Yaya.
Hey now.
Hey now, Gumbo Yaya. Grigri Gumbo Yaya.
Hey now. You got love trouble, you got a bad woman you can't control, I got just the thing for you. Something called controlling hearts and get-together drops. If you work too hard and you need a little rest, try my Easy Life Rub or put some of my Boss Fix Jam in your breakfast. Try a little bit of...
What was your reaction to the psychedelic music scene? You'd come from a very different background.
I was very turned off by it. Like, even though this became most of the venues that I'd work in later, the whole scene in general, it was like, more to me like the vibe of everybody being into the oneness of the planet. Now, that was great, and the vibe, but it was like, used to coming from Louisiana and being very paranoid and very leery of surface things, I felt like, hey, this is something that doesn't sit quite right, and it doesn't feel like there must be some real scurvy thing happening behind the scenes that I was expecting to flounce out at any moment. And then I was watching the after effects of this. I mean, I'd see these runaway kids that would hook up with our band. And, like, I was around, like, the Diggers who were, like, feeding all these runaway kids in the parks. And it was real other side to this coin of all the love and the love beads and all was in the marketplace. But there were kids that out there starving and freezing and not covered and didn't know how to take care of themselves, and it was very fortunate that there were guys like the Diggers and the Panthers feeding these kids and taking care of them.
You were born Roman Catholic. What got you so interested in voodoo?
Well, it's a real heavy part of New Orleans scene. When I was coming up, it was like, everybody I know, it's like you automatically, whether it was my grandmother or my grandfather, everybody did certain little gree-gree things. It was like the herbal remedies we took as a kid were strictly gree-gree things. And I don't think people, they look at the spells and the stuff, but that's a side of something, and it's a very small part of what gree-gree is about in Louisiana. And it's just part of the culture.
You were studying to be a priest in the Church of Voodoo and Witchcraft?
Well, what I actually did was legalize it. I chartered it so that the Reverend Mothers in New Orleans would not be busted for fortune-telling, for doing spells, and whatever they did prior to me having got a charter with the state of Louisiana. All these Reverend Mothers, who were some of the best people I ever knew, were getting busted on a regular basis for just going to hospitals and helping people. And it was ridiculous.
So you created the church to help legitimize their activities?
And it worked real well. It's like to this day they still can use this charter.
You know what I wanted to ask you about that I forgot to bring up earlier when you were talking about playing at the clubs? I had read somewhere that you were shot in the fingers, I think, during a club date. What happened? What's the story with that?
Well, I was playing a gig in Jacksonville, Florida, and Ronnie Barron, who was singing with our band at the time, he was, like, really underage. He was, like, a couple of years younger than me. And his mother had told me, look, you look out for Ronnie. And I remembered how guys had looked out for me when I was first out there. Well, I went to get Ronnie for a gig. I walk in the room, and this guy's pistol whipping him over, like, a jealous lover scene. And I went to try to get the gun out the guy's hand. And in doing it, I got my finger over the barrel instead of the handle of the gun. And as I hit the guy's hand on a rock to get the gun out of his hand, went off and blew the tip of my finger off. And I was fortunate they were able to sew the tip back on, but it's like affected me from being a guitar player. And it really took a toll. I really feel a lot of the contribution of me getting into drugs was out of connected with this incident, that I was very depressed about not being able to follow my career as a guitarist. And even though I went into playing keyboards and other things that worked out later, there was a long space of time when I was very, like, I had just geared my life to being a guitar player, and all of a sudden that was, like, gone, and it really messed my whole head up.
A couple of your latest albums really showcase your piano playing. Have you been seeing yourself as much of a pianist now as a singer or guitarist or producer or any of the other things that you've done?
Actually, I just have always looked at myself as just a musician. It plays in the rhythm section. I feel very awkward being called a piano player, a something, because what I do is, like, not necessarily, I'm not a great piano player, so to speak. I can play the piano, and I love to play the piano. I love to play music. But I just as much love to play the guitar, the bass, or the drums, or anything else in a rhythm section. And that's really my love. I feel very awkward making piano solo records because there's no interplay. And I always thought of doing something like that as like the end of the rope. From there, I'm stuck with playing the Holiday Inn circuit for the rest of my life, and I'll be in some little club, somebody drunkenly asking me to play Melancholy Baby or something, and that was my vision of this. Well, it didn't go that way, but that's a real underlying fear with this kind of thing to guys like me who've seen it happen to friends.
Dr. John MacRebinack, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed this.
Dr. John from a 1986 interview with Terry Gross. Dr. John is appearing this weekend at the New Orleans Jazz Heritage Festival. His latest CD is After the Glow on Blue Thumb Records. Coming up, a review of the new Broadway musical, Rent. This is Fresh Air. The most highly anticipated Broadway musical of the season opened this week. It's Rent, written by Jonathan Larson, who died of an aortic aneurysm the night before Rent first played off-Broadway. Rent attracted rave reviews and won the Pulitzer Prize. Ken Tucker has this review.
I think the neatest paradox about Rent is that it's a bohemian musical fantasy in which a cast member sings Bohemia is Dead. Not on Broadway, it ain't. In Jonathan Larson's vision of New York's Lower East Side at the end of the century, a motley, destitute group of musicians, writers, filmmakers, and drug addicts try to make emotional and artistic connections to each other. If that's not a bohemian utopia, what is? Like the resourceful pop artist he was, Larson picked the bones of high culture to create something new. He took Puccini's La Bohème and modernized it, giving it a grunge look but tuneful melodies. Although its title song tries to spell out the meaning of the show by talking about how tough it is these days to pay the rent, Larson clearly had a more pretentious pun in mind. He wants to show us how the social fabric of America has been rent, torn asunder by AIDS, racism, the economy, and a pervading sense of despair.
How do you document real life when real life's getting more like fiction each day? Headlines, breadlines blow my mind, and now this deadline, eviction or pay?
Rent!
How do you write a song when the chords sound wrong, though they once sounded right?
Two main protagonists of Rent are Mark, an aspiring filmmaker played with Midwestern openness and Marshall Crenshaw eyeglasses by Anthony Rapp, and Roger, an aspiring rock singer played with far too much John Cougar Mellencamp in his voice by Adam Pascal. They're white and they're straight, and Roger is HIV positive. They live in an abandoned tenement and pirate their electricity from a very long extension cord connected to the next building. Their pal Tom, played by Marvin Gaye sound-alike Jesse L. Martin, is an African-American who falls for Angel, a drag queen played with tremendous sweetness and swagger by Wilson Germaine Heredia. Friends and lovers include Mimi, a junkie with AIDS, and Maureen, a self-absorbed performance artist. Daphne Rubin Vega as Mimi and Adina Menzel as Maureen give Rent its big emotional moments, you know, what theater critics call showstoppers. Indeed, despite its assiduously funky set and dressed-down loser characters, Rent is very much a show-stopping traditional musical, a supposedly up-to-the-minute revolutionary rock opera whose tunes are inflected more by Billy Joel and Madonna than by Pearl Jam and Nirvana, whose lyrics revel in the gall it takes to cite sodomy, Stephen Sondheim, and Pee Wee Herman as prime influences to a non-bohemian audience paying $60 a pop for a seat.
The days of inspiration, playing hooky, making something out of nothing. The need to express, to communicate, to going against the grain, going insane, going mad. To loving tension, no pension, to more than one dimension. To starving for attention, hating convention, hating pretension. Not to mention, of course, hating dear old mom and dad. Riding your bike midday past the 3 to fruits, to no absolutes, absolute, to choice, to the village voice, to any passing fan, to being
theater critics, and the New York Times in particular, have been busy hyping Rent as a breakthrough in American musicals, as the next step in rock opera. As someone who listens to rock and roll for a living, the music in Rent strikes me as well done, mannerly, and exceedingly familiar. It's earthier than Jesus Christ Superstar, but not nearly as savvy and truculent as The Who's Tommy. Thinking like a theater critic, I would point out that Rent's libretto leaves a lot to be desired in the way of characterization and plot momentum. Once the various members of the 15-person cast pair off, not much happens. And speaking as a consumer of pop culture in general, I deplore the way Rent, like so many movies and TV shows, cannot resist using AIDS as an all-purpose, tear-jerking catharsis rather than a very specific tragedy. At its best, Rent is most similar to its 30-year-old predecessor, Hair, an overwhelmingly sincere effort touchingly performed by a tribe of talented unknowns. Rent doesn't embody my idea of revolutionary bohemianism, but it's a lot less self-conscious, more free and open to the world we live in, than any rock opera before it.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Alone at last.
He'll be back, I guarantee.
You've been hearing violins all night.
Anything to do with me? Are we a thing?
Darling, we're everything. Live in my house, I'll be your shelter. Just pay me back with 1,000 kisses. Be my lover, and I'll cover you.
Open your door, I'll be your tenant. Don't got much baggage to lay at your feet, but sweet kisses I've got to spare. I'll be there, and I'll cover you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.